Welcome to the Immigrant Stories Program. I'm your host, Walter Gallagher, and my interview today is with John Tripp. You know, every November we set aside a day to remember our veterans and the sacrifices they made to protect us. But for people like John Tripp, remembering is a constant. Photos on the wall of his study serve as a memorial to his band of brothers from the 10th Mountain Division and the time they spent together, sleeping in snow caves, training on the mountains near Camp Hale, and nearly freezing in the foxholes of Italy at the base of Mount Belvedere, waiting for the command to charge. John points to a photo of his bright-faced buddies and remembers something about each one of them. At 97, he's one of the precious few left to remember World War II and those that gave it their all. He starts his story remembering a trip he took with his father when he was 19 and his realization that his life was about to change.
My dad and I, at one point, were about 1938, we were up in Quebec City in Canada, and they had a fort up there on top of the mountain, up above the Frontenac Hotel, an old fort that was built by the English, and we went up there, and he had his camera, and we were going inside, and this guy stopped us, and he said, "I'm sorry, sir, but we've got to hold your camera. You can't take pictures in here." And he asked him why not, and he said, "Well, this was 38 when Adolf Hitler was coming into power, or was in, and the English knew what was going on more than we Americans did by a long shot, because we didn't have any TV or we had radio, which was pretty new."
But but what was it about that experience that made you think?
That made me realize that they knew more than we did, and that's when I started paying attention to what was going on in Europe and decided I might as well. We're going to be in it someday. So I took the physical, and then I took a mental test. Took 3 days in Holyoke, Massachusetts, at the at an Air Force base up there of some kind. And then in February, I got the letter that I was accepted as a cadet. Now, the cadet was a special entity at that time. It was a special part of the Air Corps. And when I washed out in October of 1942, I was discharged with an honorable discharge from the Army of the United States at the convenience of the government.
Why did you wash out?
I was in the navigation school because I couldn't fly because of my eyes. And I was discharged from the Army because it was a separate entity. I could have stayed in, but I went home. I'd been talking with an old friend who was in the 87th Mountain Infantry in Seattle, Fort Lewis. And so I stayed home a month and then reenlisted in the 87th Mountain Infantry Regiment and ended up at Camp Hale.
What was going on at that time?
At that time, the war, by October 42, we were involved because of Pearl Harbor in 41.
Right.
And
so things were definitely.
Yeah. And we were one regiment at Camp Hale, didn't have a division yet. There was no 10th Division. There was a 10th Division, but we weren't in it. And we went to Kiska in 1943.
Explain where Kiska is and what.
Kiska is out in the end of the Aleutian chain, not quite the end. Attu's about the end. Attu, Shimya, and Kiska is in the eastern hemisphere.
But the Aleutian Islands before you landed, that was a very hot spot, right?
Yeah, it was a hot spot. The Japanese had bombed Dutch Harbor and were heading for Alaska and the west coast of the United States.
Now, you said that if there had been Japanese there, you wouldn't be here today. Can you explain
why?
What was Describe that island and how it was fortified.
It was fortified by all kinds of underground tunnels and one thing. And the place we landed, the beach was about 20 feet wide, solid, big boulders, rocks, and then it went straight up. And it's tundra, and tundra is something that's, you take two steps forward and two steps backwards because it's so slick. And we expected the Japanese to be there, but they weren't, thank goodness.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Immigrant Stories program. I'm your host, Walter Gallagher. And my interview today is with John Tripp, a veteran of World War II. John and the men of the 87th Infantry have just landed on Kiska Island, a Japanese stronghold, only to find that it's been abandoned. So did you go in and walk through these caves? And
We explored the whole place, and this was after 5 days of not knowing that they'd just gone. Huh. And we realized that the fortifications they had were something else. They had landmines they left there. And in fact, one company, and I think it was A Company in the 87th, the guys went into a cave and rolled a field piece that was sitting there, and it was booby-trapped underneath one of the wheels, and it killed a couple of guys there. And then there was another Navy destroyer in Kiska Harbor hit a mine and blew the boat, killed a whole bunch of Navy guys. So we lost some friendly fire and that,
yeah,
bombs. A lot of men, quite a few men.
The plan when you hit that island, when you landed, was to climb that face.
That's right.
Were you outfitted and trained to?
We were trained to go up. You know, a mountain didn't bother us at all. We were used to mountains.
You had ropes and.
No, we didn't need ropes. It was unroped. You know, it wasn't tactical.
So you would have free climbed that.
Free climbed, oh yeah, with, slipping around.
With your gear. Oh, man, that would have been awful.
Yeah, and part of the regiment landed on nice beaches, and they didn't meet any resistance either.
Now you served your time as a cadet and came back home. You could have just been done, right? You had served your...
Well, I think I probably would have been drafted if I hadn't re-enlisted.
Okay. But you didn't just re-enlist, you went with an infantry division. Why did you go from being a flyboy to an infantry
person?
Yeah,
I went from $75 a month down to $50 a month in the infantry.
Well, what prompted you to do that?
Because I had skied before. And in fact, to get into the regiment, the 87th, ski troops call it, we had to have 3 letters of recommendation to get in the Army. Unbelievable, but we did.
3 letters of recommendation.
Yep.
For that, because it was more of an elite corps, right?
Yeah, somebody had to know that we were used to being, you know, skiing or rock climbing or lived a lot of our life in the outdoors.
Right. And you had.
Back in
Vermont, you were...
Connecticut.
Connecticut, yeah. Sorry. You were an outdoors person. Your family was outdoors...
My family was partially outdoors, not like I was. I think I was the only one in the family that really loved the outdoors.
What was it that lit you up about that? What was it that excited you about the outdoors since you didn't have...
I just was an outdoors person.
Huh.
I liked my bike, and I rode all over the country with my bicycle, not all over, Connecticut mostly.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Immigrant Stories program. I'm your host, Walter Gallagher. And my interview today is with John Tripp, a World War II veteran and a member of the 10th Mountain Division. So let me take you back. You landed at the Aleutian Islands, but you had to be trained before you landed there. Talk to me about Camp Hale.
Camp Hale.
Tell me about Camp Hale.
Mountain climbing and skiing and all that business, but
describe that place. What did it look like back then?
What?
Camp Hale. What was it like?
They were still finishing building up there. When we came back from Kiska, they had already started the other two regiments, the 85th and 86th, to build this division. And it took three regiments. And a total of, we had a light regiment, about 15,000 men, where a full regiment, a big regular one, would be probably 20,000, give or take.
So when you were there training, how many people do you think were in Camp Hale then?
In Camp Hale at the time, there were probably about maybe 5,000, because we had artillery, we had all kinds of, you know, medics. Of course, you have to have medics when you're in the infantry, especially. And
what was training like there at Camp Hale?
Training at Camp Hale was probably more intensive, a little tougher on everybody than when we were in Italy in combat.
Well, it's one of the coldest places.
It was cold. Yeah, we have maneuvers where we'd be out for 2 or 3 weeks with no fires, living in maybe a tent or even just a snow cave or something like that. And then in late 1944, that's when we went to Camp Swift, Texas for flatland training. And then we went to,
what was that like, Camp Swift?
Camp Swift, oh, I was married at the time, and Noreen and I had an apartment in Austin, right across from the University of Texas. And, it was hot. Yeah. We'd have 25-mile force marches and 8-mile we had to do in 2 hours, one of them. With full field pack, supposedly. A lot of guys stuffed pillows in their rucksacks and made it look like they had a full pack. But you had your rifle and, of course, ammunition. And I carried a rifle for better part of 3 years.
Was there any idea about where they were going to send you? Did you have any clue?
We had no idea till we got on the boat.
So when did you find time to fall in love and get married?
Well, I met Reen on a weekend. 3 or 4 of us went down to Denver, and I met her on a golf course. And as I always tell people, I haven't played since. But and then in 1944, we got married March 18th. And when I had written to my dad, told him what I was going to do, he wrote back, and he says, "Dear John, any damn fool that takes on 2 battles at once, I have no sympathy for whatsoever."
Oh.
He had a good sense of New England humor.
So you met this woman on the golf course. So what was it that sparked?
A Wilshire golf course out on Colorado Boulevard.
Yeah? And what was it about her that lit
I
you up?
I don't know. And something turned me on.
Yeah.
We had no sex, no none of that nonsense.
Right. But she liked you. Did you know that she liked you?
She apparently liked me because she told me after, she said, "John, when I met you first, I went home and told my mom, that's the guy I'm going to live the rest of my life with."
Really? She knew.
She knew.
Did it feel like that for you?
Yeah. And she helped me build a house in Denver back in right after World War II. And then this house we live in here in Carbondale, we've been here almost 50 years.
You guys got married, but you were still in the middle of the war.
Oh, yeah, that was right. That's where my dad wrote that to me. Exactly. 2 battles at once.
I'm sure back then there was this immediacy. I mean, the world was in chaos.
Oh,
so.
Yeah.
So having someone in your life helps ground you in a way, right?
Yeah, no? I think, you know, you're young and you don't think of a lot of things we do as we get older.
Well, did you think that maybe you wouldn't come back?
Oh, you know, I never gave that a thought. And when I was in Italy, I was never really afraid. I didn't want to get hurt, but I did.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Immigrant Stories program. I'm your host, Walter Gallagher. And my interview today is with John Tripp, a veteran of World War II. John and members of the 10th Mountain Division are headed into battle with the Germans in the Apennine Mountains of Italy. And when did you find out you were going to Italy?
We found out after we got on the boat.
Oh, so.
We didn't know where they were going to land us. We landed, we went through the Straits of Gibraltar and looking at Africa and Spain and landed in Naples in the middle of the night and got off and marched through town, got on railroad freight cars. They were short, as they are in Europe, short freight cars, about 40 guys in a car, and headed north.
So there were certain parts of Italy that weren't occupied by the enemy, right?
At that time, yeah.
Yes.
They'd had Anzio, and they had all those big battles. And
so they'd cleared that area?
Pretty much. In fact, we stopped at Rome, and we were safe there. We had to get off the train and use the facilities in the railroad station. Of course, it was in a cramped freight car. It's not much fun.
Wow, no, I would imagine.
But
were you cautioned by your superiors to be careful because it was still not totally safe?
We weren't totally safe, but in those days, wars were a little more civilized, I guess. When even in Italy, when we get off the front line and go back a half a mile or a mile, you could sit down, have a cigarette and a beer, and not worry. But not today.
Yeah.
Wars are different.
So you were headed out of Rome and where?
We ended up in Florence. We ended up in Pisa. And we had to clean all our weapons because cosmoline, which is a greasy bunch of crap, you have to put on all your armament to keep them from rusting. And we got those all cleaned up, and then we moved up to a town, Lucca. It's a walled city, and we were outside the town, living in olive oil country.
What was it like? Was that country shot up at the time and from the war?
No, Lucca, I think I never went into town. They never let us go in. I didn't. And I think they escaped it. But the Germans had occupied it.
Oh.
And they were still in the neighborhood, so we had to be pretty careful living in foxholes. And
did you have encounters with them at this point, or was
not
it all still?
At that point. We had a few, had to go out at night a couple of times looking, see if we could find anything, but we didn't. Just luckily. And this was up in the Apennines, but it was. Well, the first of 1945, just about New Year's, when we were up there living, but there was very little snow. It was an easy winter, thank goodness.
So the Apennine Mountains, so that your Camp Hill experience got you ready for...
Yeah, you know, the guys were so used to living in mountains, didn't deter them at all.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the Immigrant Stories program. I'm your host, Walter Gallagher, and my interview today is with John Tripp, a World War II veteran and a member of the 10th Mountain Division. He is describing the assault on the Apennine Mountains in Italy, pushing the Germans north. One of the people who was part of that assault and part of the 10th Mountain Division was an internationally known skier named Torger Togl.
Anyway, then we moved up further into the Apennines before we hit Mount Belvedere, which was our first main battle. Mount Belvedere the Americans had tried to take it, the English or somebody tried to take it a couple of times before we went, and we succeeded in doing it. But I think Riva Ridge was right across down into the valley, then up River Ridge. And once they secured that, we were a little safer because their artillery they had up there was stopped. Belvedere was the front line.
So you were starting to see
action.
Action.
Oh yeah, we lost quite a few guys on Belvedere, and we weren't there but a couple of days when they hit us with all kinds of artillery, because it seemed like the Germans were always up above us a little bit. In fact, I had a runner. I had a mortar section, and I had a runner, and he and his brother were in the company, and they were young guys from Tacoma or Seattle, and they got out one nice day, take off their shirts. They no more than got their shirts off to get tanned, then we got shelled good. Wow. I mean, that was a flag for the Germans.
So no
more sunbathing.
So they hit you hard, but you were pushing them north, so up the mountain.
Backwards, yeah. Well, I got hit on March 3rd, same day the Torgatogo got killed, and we lost a lot of guys on that push. And I got hit and ended up in the hospital in Livorno. Leghorn, people in America call it Leghorn. It's Livorno, Italy. It's over near Carrara on the west coast.
Explain how that happened. Can you take me through how?
We were moving so fast, we bypassed this character, German, that was in a foxhole of some kind, and he had an automatic weapon, like a machine gun, and he got a few of our guys. That's the last they know of anything. And me and several others got wounded pretty good. I got hit in both legs, both knees.
Man. And you still get around? You recovered?
Oh, yeah, I recovered. They told me I might not ski again, but I...
Proved them wrong.
Like Pete Seibert, they told him he'd never ski again. He was in the 46 Olympics, so who knows?
So what was that like for you? I mean, as a young man to see...
Well, getting shot, you know, felt like a bunch of bee stings. But I knew I'd been hit. And I said one word, and I'm not going to repeat that right now because you'll blank it out. And took my pills, whatever I was supposed to take, and slid down the side of a mountain on my behind, most of it, because they were still firing at us. And I started walking back, and I got back kind of out of range, you know, a few hundred yards off the front, sat down on a rock and lit up a cigarette and had a chocolate bar. But when I got up, I couldn't walk anymore. My legs, both of them, stiffened up. And a couple of medics tried to help me walk, and that didn't work. So finally they got a litter and hauled me back to the hospital.
Were you shot in your thighs or your calves?
No, I got one in the calf, and that bullet they took out, and I got hit in this knee, and they took the bullet out of my right knee, and the rest of them were flesh wounds. I was lucky.
Did you lose dear friends in those battles?
Oh, I lost a lot of good guys, and we lost a lot of good friends I'd been with for almost 3 years.
Well, a lot of guys, when they come back, carry that with them. You know, there's post-traumatic stress. How did you deal with that?
I hear about this post-traumatic stress in today's. Maybe some of our guys had it, but I didn't. I think I tried to erase a lot of it out of my mind. And I was married and had a child. My daughter was born January 8th when I was in a foxhole up in the Apennines somewhere. And she lives in Paonia.
So she was born in January and 2 months later...
1945, and yeah, and two
you
months...
You got shot.
2 months later, I got nailed.
When did you get to see her, finally, your daughter?
I 8 months later, when I got home, I saw Judy. And it was good to be home.
So did they patch you up and send you back into battle, or did you?
I didn't go back into battle. By the time I got out of the hospital and back to the company, the war had been over maybe for a week. pretty much over, and we were in northern Italy, and then we ended up in a town called Caporetto, which is right on the Italian-Yugoslavia border, right in the Alps, a beautiful area. And then from there, we went back down to Florence, and then we ended up in Naples, and that's where they put us on the boat and brought us home.
What was homecoming like?
We didn't have great parades or great crowds, and nobody, you know, everybody went back home to their families or friends and looked for a job.
That was John Tripp. John returned home to his wife, Reen, and together they spent the next 72 years raising a family and running a successful business and sitting on their deck at the base of Sopras. John lost Reen to Alzheimer's disease last year. Thanks for listening, and special thanks to John and men and women like him.